Hello and welcome to today's Clear Spots, which is a joint production of Little Atoms and Six Pillars to Persia. The recent Iranian elections were mired in controversy and accusations of corruption. Early in August, around 100 so-called opposition leaders appeared in a Tehran courtroom in what has been described as a Stalinist show trial. They had been accused of fomenting a velvet revolution. This programme focuses on one of those accused, the Canadian journalist and filmmaker Mazyar Bahari. The show is presented by Fari Bradley of Six Pillars to Persia and myself, Neil Denny of Little Atoms. Joining us to discuss Mazyar's current plight and his life and career as a journalist are the filmmaker Simon Ardizone, who collaborated as editor on a number of Mazyar's films, writer Malu Halassa, co-editor with Mazyar of the book Transit Tehran, and Little Atoms' own Padre Greedy, joining us tonight as news editor of Index on Censorship. So I'll hand over to Fari now to get us started.
Yes, well, I think it's important that we put this in context. I mean, Mazyar's not the only person who's been imprisoned following the recent electoral kind of upsurge. But, you know, he's known to us, Malu, Simon, they've both worked with him. He's been a guest on Six Pillars to Persia. And if there's anything we can do, we can care about the people we know. I mean, that's like the minimum. So I hope that by talking about this, we might inspire people to talk amongst themselves and investigate. I don't know what can be done about Mazyar's position. Malu probably fill us in on some more of his familial connections that he's made since he's been in prison. Well, I mean, didn't he telephone to his mother?
Well, he was able to do something like maybe two or three phone calls to his mother. But last week on Thursday, his mother was allowed to meet him. And she was accompanied by his brother-in-law. They had a short meeting, and that Mazyar said that the interrogation wasn't over. He's being interrogated quite heavily. That the brother-in-law said to Paula, Mazyar's wife, that Mazyar is strong mentally. So we don't really know what happened at the meeting, but they were able to meet. And also, Mazyar's mother was able to bring him a form for the power of attorney. One of the reasons why Mazyar has not been able to see a lawyer is because he had to sign the power of attorney, and no one would give him the form inside. He's in Evin prison, so no one would give him the form inside. So they had to sort of wait until someone was able to see him.
Let's just go back a little, and I'm going to ask Simon to give us a bit of background, and let's talk about who Mazyar is.
Sure. Mazyar was born in Iran, and then when he was a teenager, he made a film that the authorities, was shortly after the revolution, he made a film that the authorities really didn't like. And so he set out on his own to really live a life in exile. He started out in Pakistan, and then from there moved to Canada, where he studied at university and became a filmmaker. And then I think about 10 years ago, Mazyar set up base here in the United Kingdom and has been working as a journalist, a writer and a filmmaker in documentary and current affairs ever since then. So some of the broadcasters that Mazyar's worked with are Channel 4, Channel 4 News. He's also worked for BBC's Panorama. In fact, he did Panorama earlier this year on the British troops coming out of Basra. And he's also an Emmy nominee. He made a film that HBO picked up in the United States. He's a very, very accomplished man.
Can we then perhaps talk about the events that led up to his arrest? He was in Iran covering the elections for Newsweek, I understand.
Well, he was there. He had gone. He initially went to cover the elections, not for Newsweek, but to do a Panorama documentary. He had come out after that. He'd come back to Britain after that was done, because he called looking for me. I don't have a mobile phone. So when people look for me, they get really annoyed because they can't find me.
Yeah.
So he was really annoyed, and he was leaving messages around for me. And then he went back into Iran because it was heated up after the elections. So he went, you know, Mazyar has been a special correspondent in Newsweek for quite a while now. I'm not sure how long, but maybe 8 years. And he's all, you know, he's worked with Chris Dickey and quite prominent American writers when they go to Iran. So he was there covering what was going on for Newsweek. But also, what was happening is that although he was covering it, when they said that there was a news blackout and that reporters were not supposed to report, Mazyar wasn't reporting. So he was picked up on Sunday morning June 21st, I think 7 a.m., unidentified men went to his mother's house, took him out of bed, grabbed his computers, and the mother, Maziar's mother, I think, she's 80-something. She's in her early 80s. And she kept asking and saying, well, where are you taking him and who are you? And the men would only say that Maziar was going to be detained as their guest. So it's quite a scary scenario, one that we're not really used to in Britain or the United States.
Can we say for sure what he's actually been accused of?
No. Maziar hasn't actually been accused of anything yet, which is worrying me. He has been brought out in these trials, in these mass trials, as a kind of witness, actually, to add weight to the prosecution idea that there is a Western conspiracy. So Maziar has been brought out, and we don't know. Of course, we don't know exactly what's happening in prison, but I mean certainly from appearances, from pictures, he looks. I mean, initially in the first appearances, looked quite stressed. So he's been brought out to say that yes, this is how the Western media works to foment orange revolutions. Just as they did in Georgia and Ukraine, and I know because I've worked for the BBC and I've worked for Newsweek and so on. So he's useful at the moment to the Iranian authorities, but as Malou was saying, because he's in this complete limbo of not being charged. Subsequently, he does not have an attorney. He's not allowed to appoint an attorney. He doesn't have proper rights in terms of visitation and things. They're keeping him in a complete limbo, which is quite scary. We don't know how these trials will go on. We also don't know how much more pressure will be put on Maziar, whether Maziar will be charged, or what will happen.
But there was a deputy prosecutor said that he'd made some incriminating remarks. So what would that mean?
It's hard to really say. It's more than smoking mirrors. It's more than fractured. You know, who knows? It seems like it changes. The authorities would say that they're going to try a certain number of people in a couple days' time, and then they don't do that, but then they do something else. You know, it's really hard. I think what's quite interesting about Iran at the moment is that the people that should have the contacts, like the Canadian government or Newsweek, the people who should be close to the people who are holding Maziar, nobody really knows who they are. Nobody knows how to get in touch with them. So it's almost as if the accusation from the authorities that there's been this velvet revolution coup in society. What's happened, I think, in Iran is that there's been a hardline coup inside the government, mm-hmm. and that you have various hardline factions fighting with each other. So we're not sure exactly who's holding Maziar or how people can talk to them. Who are these people?
Yes, I think it reflects the uncertainty in the broader Iranian electoral scene, political scene, not broader than electoral. That no one is, and again, the complexity of the Iranian system, full stop. I mean, we don't know who took Maziar. We don't know who has him now. We don't know under whose orders all this is being done. Even the people being put on trial, there's a vast range of people. It's very,
and a vast range of what I'm told by Iranians that I know, a vast range of security services.
Yeah.
Some named, some unnamed, some belonging to the supreme leader, some belonging to the president. So there's a real kind of jostling going on that our press also, they're hindered. They don't have the contacts. They're not on the inside. So nobody knows.
So, Simon, Maziar is a Canadian citizen, so what are the Canadian government actually doing? I mean, we've just seen, for instance, Bill Clinton's just appeared in North Korea and rescued a couple of stray journalists. So what are the Canadian government actually, have they made any noises?
I think it's so ironic that Bill Clinton went and rescued two journalists who had entered North Korea illegally. Whereas in fact Maziar was fully under license from the media ministry in Tehran, working completely legally, and the Canadian government have really done very little. So far they've made, I guess, what you might term as polite diplomatic noises. They've asked for access to Maziar, and they've sent letters saying that they feel that the authorities in Iran have been very naughty diplomatically for not giving them access to Maziar. But they haven't gone high profile with this. They haven't really demanded to see Maziar in any of the normal institutions like the United Nations. And I personally, I feel that it's very important that they do so. These sorts of human rights cases can have an enormous impact, and it's very important that governments in the West put their money where their mouths where their money is.
But also, Simon, don't the Canadians also have a history of losing Canadian Iranians?
Well, yes, they do. I mean, there was a case a few years ago, and I've forgotten her name.
No, it was a woman.
It was a woman.
Woman,
yes.
Photographer.
It was a woman.
Terrible,
photographer.
Yeah.
And it was a very high-profile case, and the Canadians, I think there's still a lot of diplomatic fallout from that.
But it was high-profile way too late. I mean, she was already dead by the
yes.
time.
Yes. Yeah. And also, recently, you wrote a blog for a Canadian that appeared
yes,
on a Canadian.
Yes, I did, yeah.
And what was the reaction to that?
Well, the reaction so far has been, has been very good. I think a lot of Canadians are disappointed in their government. And feel that more of this needs to be done, and that people like Maziar need to be defended and supported.
The one thing about the campaign is that the Canadian media, like CBC, and the Star and the Toronto Globe, they've been fantastic. Reporters have been calling. They've been very interested. They want to run this story. They want to be involved. So I think that there seems to be a disconnect between the government and actually the media or the people there that are very interested and worried.
I think it's always a problem when you go down diplomatic channels, because there are always other games being played. And I don't know what the Canadians are playing at it, and what it is that's going on behind closed doors, but that's definitely the impression that some of us are getting at the moment.
One of the things I just wanted to talk about is that you talked briefly about that, Maziar was under license by the authorities. Mm-hmm. He's been an operating, active journalist in Iran for quite a long time, doing documentary films and writing for Newsweek. And that what was interesting is I when I was in New York, I went to see Maziar's editor at Newsweek, Nasid Hajjari. And Nasid told me that when they were planning to do a big story on Ahmadinejad and put him on the cover, Ahmadinejad's people asked for Maziar to do the interview. Now, Newsweek said no because they would never honor a request like that. They want to send who they want to send, and probably there was a good chance that they would have sent Maziar anyway, but because he was asked for, they didn't send him. But I mean that, at the highest levels of the Iranian government, they know Maziar. He's practically interviewed chief prosecutors across the board for his documentary films. So he's been very visible to them, and they know his work.
Well, according to Patrick, he's being kept as a witness rather than as a accused. So it may be that they feel his presence there will lend weight to what's the mm-hmm. case.
As a high-profile person known both to the Iranian authorities and both to a large section of the Iranian population, he lends weight, the things that he's saying or being made to say does lend weight to this, to the various prosecutions which are going ahead, and to the for want of a better phrase, conspiracy theory which seems to have completely
gripped
the regime. And I suppose it's not just now, it's been for the past 2-3 years, the regime has been obsessed. Well, since Ukraine and Georgia went, basically, they have been obsessed with the idea of there is a Velvet Revolution being planned by these various people, by the BBC and the Open Society Foundation and all these external forces, and obviously the Zionists. But it's been an obsession for 2-3 years, and one could look at possibly the crackdown, the laughable election result and the subsequent crackdown as the point they needed. They've been wanting this crackdown for about 3 years because they're so scared of pro-democracy movements which they portray as externally influenced.
Let's talk about what Index on Censorship have been doing then. Tell us about the campaign.
Mm-hmm. Well, Maziar had previously written for Index on Censorship. Funnily enough, about being imprisoned. So when we found out what had happened with Maziar, immediate feeling was, as often, something must be done. What the danger was that it was at the height of the protest time, and the danger was we did not want to be seen as here is a bunch of Westerners interfering for their Westerner friend. So we thought we will get a petition together. But rather than have an open petition, which would just inviting people, which would become dominated as most web-based things do, which would become dominated by US and UK voices, we decided very specifically to go on a route of finding as many international voices as we could. So getting a very strong balance of 100 people from international media. So working with the Committee to Protect Journalists in New York under the wonderful Joel Silver, we spent several days looking for journalists from, looking for really the most high profile, respected names from as many countries as possible, and you know, not to have any kind of Western bias to it, to have people from throughout the Middle East, throughout Central Asia, down to Sub-Saharan Africa.
Sounds like a huge effort. On.
It was, yeah. It was a massive effort, I must say, and at this point, you know, but it's the nature of these things. Occasionally, when with an organisation like Index, you do. With something like this, you do have to drop everything else and focus.
I think that most people know Index as the magazine, but Index is also a campaigning organization.
Well, exactly, yes. I mean, the magazine is one part of what we do. But, and as I said, Mazier had written for the magazine. So we, with using international contacts with CPJ, we put together this, well, I think quite impressive list of international media, and we were very conscious, not just that there wasn't a lot of Westerns, but there wasn't a bunch of liberals as well. So we're very pleased that we got several conservative Egyptian and Lebanese writers to sign up.
Is it your petition that has Noam Chomsky on it?
Yes, we got Chomsky.
Yeah. They got some big names. They got
some
impressive
names.
Here. We're proud of this petition, these petitions.
So this was published in a huge range of media. Obviously, we also worked with Newsweek on this, because Newsweek have been very busy, and Newsweek deserve credit for the amount of work they have put in to the campaign. So we got people like Roberto Saviano, the author of Gomorra, and Lydia Cacho from Mexico, who's done fantastic work on corruption in the church there, and is a huge figure in Mexico. Marianne Pearl, the wife of Daniel Pearl, who was killed by Taliban in Pakistan.
The editor of Al Arabiya.
Editor of Al Arabiya, Ibrahim Issa from Al Dastur. The editor of The Economist. Who else have we got here?
So some of these people are in hiding. How did you get them to sign?
They can find anybody.
We can find anybody. Abdul Bayat from Al-Quds Al-Arabi, Wilfram Banga from the Zimbabwean. You know, we tried to get as many people as possible. So following up from that, I mean, the ad went through. There was simultaneously, and I think this reflects Malziar's work, the CPJ and Index focused very much on journalists. And you know, media commentators and so on, people like Chomsky and so on. On top of that, PEN America, PEN the Writers Group, and PEN Canada put together a wonderful list of novelists. And the International Documentary Film Festival Amsterdam put together an astounding list of, pretty much anyone who's ever made a good documentary and is still alive has signed this. It's
Simon,
it's,
you're on there.
I'm not a good enough documentary.
No, and I'm not a good enough journalist to be on the Index. And that was fine. We accepted that for Mazyar.
But, you know, we want to keep it like here are big people, big names. You know, these are people who cannot be, you know, kind of.
What's amazing about the petitions and the big names? I mean, you could read some of the names from Penn. They're very. I mean, it's remarkable, you know, like
Nadine Gordimer and
Edward Albee, Martin Amis, Atwood, you know, just all sorts of Ian Buruma, Peter Carey, all sorts of people from Alan DeBottom, Don DeLillo, you know, Doctorow. It's incredible, these names. But what's interesting is that petitions, they need these big names. The Iranians like celebrities, too. That's what's interesting.
That's what I was thinking. I mean, who does actually Iran care about? Who are the people that Iran would most feel
I don't know
some weight behind?
I don't know if it's that they care about individuals. I think they care about the spread of the countries. The index on censorship, you had like something like 20, 30 countries represented.
Yeah.
The same with Penn, the same with the IDFA petition, was that it wasn't just those countries that are conspiring to take over Iran. I mean, when you think of America's foreign policy now, they don't have time for Iran. You know, the Britons, they can barely handle what they're handling. So, you know, these countries that are perceived to be the great Satans of Iran, the Iranians just want to see like a global reach, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, Simon's just been very modest there, saying that he's not a good enough filmmaker to be on that list. But I mean, you've worked with Maziar on five or six films?
Five films.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about your experiences of working with Maziar.
Well, Maziar and I first met in 2007. And we made a couple of films for Al Jazeera English, which is based here in London. And working with Maziar is he's a very, very special man, because he has a very deep knowledge both of the Western media and sort of the Anglo-Saxon way of doing things. And, of course, he has a very deep knowledge of Iran, and that's very rare. And he is able, I think, to communicate something of Iran to the West, which most foreign journalists, to Iran, simply can't do. And the depth of knowledge that Maziar has is really exceptional. And so he's very much a bridge builder between the two cultures.
Do you think, sorry to interrupt you, I was going to ask what his aims were. I mean, do you think that was particularly important to him, the idea of being a bridge builder?
Yes, I think definitely important to him. And I think it was, in fact, probably his main aim. Because when you look at Maziar's work, what you don't see is one style. You don't, or even one media. What you see is a man who is really politically committed to opening up Iran, or at least not so much opening up Iran, but allowing the forces that are in Iran that want to see an open Iran. And those are conservative forces as well as progressive forces. You know, it's a very complex situation. You know, he was on their side. He wanted Iranians to, and the position of Iran, to be normalized within the world, to be a normal trading partner in the World Trade Organization, to be a normal member of these sort of, you know, and to take its place in the region. And the region is not a great place to be, and Iran really has to do something about that, because it has Afghanistan, Pakistan and Iraq. It has three very, very unstable countries on its borders. What was extraordinary about working with Maziar was that for all that kind of weight and, you know, history and geography and all the rest of it, he has a terrific sense of humour. He is very naughty, and he's always able to bring something out of that. So what you're not getting from Maziar is a kind of, you know, I'm a big journalist and I'm going to tell you all about this because it's jolly important. What you're getting is somebody who's really getting under the skin, who's really showing something for what it is. And Maziar was a very compassionate man. He was a man with a great deal of empathy. But ultimately, he had what I regard as a pitiless gaze. He was not afraid of looking at anything. And I've seen him interview torture victims and take them through every single stage of their torture. I've seen him interview politicians and take them through every single stage of their position. And he does it the same way each time. It's with a mixture of real attention to detail and facts and a sense of humour. And if we can, I would like to play a clip of Maziar. This is with Sir Sam Fall. Sir Sam Fall is a British diplomat who in 1952 recommended to the British government that a coup be mounted in Iran. And the reason for this was because Sir Sam Fall was terrified that the communists were going to take over. And it was the height of Stalinism, as you know, for many people know that the USSR was the northern neighbour of Iran at the time, had previously invaded Iran during the Second World War and had only just been persuaded to get out. And everyone was terrified that the communists would take over. And so Sir Sam Fall was one of the team that persuaded the Americans, the CIA, to oust the then Prime Minister of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh. And this was part of a film made for the BBC World last year. It's based on an enormous range of sources, and well, we'll listen to some takes of Maziar's interview technique and his encounter with Sir Sam Fall.
In Generally speaking, I would say the Iranians are a very attractive people, not in the Western sense trustworthy.
What do you mean exactly, much less trustworthy?
That's just trustworthy. Well, I mean, you couldn't rely on them. But we did succeed. We were lucky in finding trustworthy Iranians. Zahedi was my idea because he was tough, ruthless, military, and a respectable member of the establishment.
In October 1952, Mossadegh discovered the plot and cut all diplomatic ties with Britain.
Do you think the Mossadegh did the right thing by closing the embassy of a country that was interfering in the affairs of his country?
Yes, I think he did. I think he had reason. I think it was quite justly we were closed, and it was done nicely without killing anybody.
How would you describe someone who advocates British policies and receives money from the British embassy for advocating those policies?
Well, I suppose the Iranians would call him a British dude.
What do you call them?
I would call them a sensible cooperator.
Fantastic.
So that was Maziar's interview technique. And that was a very long interview, and obviously we selected the very best bits of it. And I think there were several. Well, listening to that interview again, it's extraordinary the level of honesty that Maziar approaches his subject with. Here's a man who has encouraged a coup in another country. At the time, he thought for the best reasons, and I think Sir Samphal still thinks that he did it for the best reasons, and that he prevented the communists from taking over in Iran. But equally, however much sympathy one has with that point of view, you know, he did what he did, and this is what Maziar is confronting him with. And I think that he's doing it in such a gentle way. You know, you can imagine what that would be like on the Today programme. I mean, it wouldn't sound anything like that. And yet here's Maziar just pushing him, sort of saying, OK, you know, what's this all about? What, you know, when you did this, what were you really doing? And I think that that's a skill and an attitude, not just to documentary filmmaking, but to life, which is very exceptional because it's not confrontational. It's not led by ego.
Yeah. It's non-judgmental.
It's non-judgmental.
Yeah.
In fact, while we were making it's a good point, Farry, because while we were making the film, I kept on saying to Maziar, you know, come on, you've really got to say what you think, Maziar. You know, this is, you know, we haven't got the story yet. It's just, it just dribbles on and on and on with lots of people saying lots and lots of things. You know, the film was at 90 minutes instead of an hour at this point. And Maziar was going, oh, well, you know, I just want the audience, they've got to make up their own mind. You know, it's like, oh, they got the time to. They got 90 minutes instead of an hour. But Maziar was very, very concerned not to over-editorialise.
I mean, I often get this when it's something that I put out, say to people, you know, what do you think I should ask someone? People have very strong opinions, and they've formed these opinions from pieces of news that they've picked up. And then here's the chance to meet this person and hear from them directly in a kind of even way, their version of the story. Why would you want to come at them at this angle that you've perceived from someone who's, you know, reported another way? And I felt a bit weak once when I've asked. I mean, soon I'm going to interview John Hoppy Hopkins, who's an activist. And people were just railing about him because of his past with drugs and so on. But I felt weak at that point for saying, look, I don't want to judge him. But hearing you say that, Simon, and like, it's great. I think it's probably a different type. What do you think, Neil, about interviewing people? You've interviewed so many.
Yeah, well, this is, Little Atoms is famous, if anything, for our rather meek interviewing style. We're the anti-Paxmans.
It's not meek, Neil. It's allowing people to talk. It's allowing people to talk. You know? And again, you could hear that very clearly with what Maziar was doing. He it wasn't necessarily leading questions. It's asking people, what were you doing? Why did you do it? Why do you think you did it?
What effect did it
have? And as you say, then people get a much clearer reflection of what is actually going on and what's going on in people's heads, which is important.
And the other thing is that interview was one of the best researched interviews I have ever seen. Maziar read all the dispatches from the embassy in Tehran that went to the Foreign Office in London at the time. Wow. He and his wife Paula were down the National Archive day after day, pouring through hundreds of documents. And literally, you know, and some of those documents are in the film. There aren't very many journalists who would do that. Most would pick up a book, have a look at Google, and poodle through. But Maziar went back to the sources and then went to those people with those sources.
Hmm. We've talked about how Maziar wants to be, his aim is to be, some sort of bridge between the West and Iran. And although we've established he's not strictly on trial for anything, you know, presumably the Iranian government is suspicious of the fact that he would probably be, you know, biased or even some sort of stooge of the Western media. And I just want to talk about the idea of, is it even possible to be unbiased?
I don't like the word bias in Maziar's case, because I don't see him bringing a particular point of view or a particular agenda. You know, he's in favour of an open society, and he wants, you know, people to be able to pretty much run their own affairs. But you know what? A lot of conservatives want that. A lot of progressives want that. A lot of liberals. But, you know, all sorts of different people want that. I think that he comes to every situation with a lot of knowledge and an openness to what the situation is. I think when we're looking at the reaction of the Iranian government to a person like that, I think one of the most... We cannot think of the Iranian state in the way that we think of, say, the British or even the American state. It is a very, very fragile and delicate thing, and has been for a very... I mean, literally hundreds of years. And this is a result of history. What you have is lots of different factions desperately scrabbling for power and establishing some sort of political stability within the country. And so the people that hate Maziar, it literally could be one person within one of the security agencies who just doesn't like him and who so far has been able to pull strings.
Didn't he publish an 11-page confession or something? They published a confession by him.
There was a confession that was published, yeah, definitely. But, you know, if you talk to the Iranian dissidents, they'll all talk about how they've given those confessions, and that really, once you're captured like that, it's no good to be defiant. It will get you nowhere. So you do whatever your captors need you to do, and or make you do. You do it.
Well, certainly. I mean, as soon as you said F in prison, my heart just dropped. Mm-hmm. I mean, we all know that's the most infamous and evil prison of...
Yes, but at least we know where Maziar is.
Yes.
There, for a long time, we didn't even know where he was. So it adds that level of, like, Kafka craziness to it that you don't really know. I mean, yes, I've talked...
Best of the devil you know, yeah.
Best of the devil you know, exactly.
I mean, if anyone's seen Mark Wolfboff's films where he's, you know, he's tried to document how he felt at Evan Prison, or you've read about anyone else's experience there, you'll know it's an almost lawless place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
but another thing we don't know about Maziar is whether he's really alone in solitary confinement or if he's with a group of people. We do know that he's allowed out for, like, exercise 3 times a day for a half hour. So, I mean, we just don't know. I mean, then there are all these other stories that's coming out of the prison and what's happening to some of the student protesters, rapes, violent attacks, torture. So there's all sorts of things going on in that one prison that, you know, one wing might not know what the other wing is doing.
Mm-hmm. Malo, I'd like to talk to you about your experiences of working as a journalist with Maziar and experience of working on Transit Tehran. But to get into that, if we can just carry on a little bit, we were just talking, Simon, about although you took a dislike to the term bias, but there's a really interesting point in the introduction to the book, which is that, you know, the artists, photographers, journalists that you speak to would claim to be apolitical, but as far as the government is concerned, because they're not following an official policy of how an artist should behave, they are, basically, you know, they do have a position.
Well, I think that really what it is that the government or the authorities have problems with, they have a problem with documentary and social realism, that they have a problem with people saying what their lives are like, because maybe what their lives are like contravenes this sort of official version of the Islam, of life in the Islamic Republic, and that a lot of our contributors in transit Tehran, they are really just documenting their lives. They're talking about their neighborhoods. They're talking about like where they grew up or what it was like when they went to the beach as a child as opposed to what it's like when they go to the beach now. Or Majid Saidi, another photographer who was also arrested, he attended a demonstration of done by people who want to be martyrs. You know, so I Majid Saidi, he wrote a couple of notes about the demonstration, but he really felt that he didn't want to comment on it. He wanted just to show. Showing is almost more than enough in the case of Iran. If you show the things that are going on there, you don't have to say this is bad, this is good. Just that they exist is kind of surprising to the people there and also to people outside. I would say I met Maziar in the middle 1990s. He was part of this huge, I know a lot of Canadians in London, and he was part of this posse, like introduced him to me. And he was interested, he was just starting out as a journalist, and we did some work together for the Observer Syndicated News Service writing about Iran. He was still living on the outside, and he had not yet made the decision to go back and live in the country and to report in the country. And I think that what I remember from those days is that he was a good reporter. He was very interested. He was very motivated. But he wanted to show Iran in the widest sense. I think that when you talk about the Middle East and you look at British media, you see a very narrow strands. You know, this is a region at war. This is a region that has trouble with its women. Like you can almost say there like might be five like rules about it that you see a lot that you hear and see a lot. I mean, the BBC does do an in-depth reporting and Channel 4 does do in-depth reporting. But for the most part, if you look at the newspapers, it's a very like simplistic view of what's going on there. And I think that for Maziar is that he wanted to show all of it. But not only that he wanted to show all of it, he wanted the people there to show it themselves. Transit is a series that I do. It's usually new writing and images from Middle Eastern cities. I did one like a few years ago, Transit Beirut. And when I did Transit Beirut, Maziar and I have been talking about a Transit Tehran for a really long time. And the people, the contributors, we have something like 31 contributors to the book, from photojournalists to people who are writing fiction, you know, just across the board. And a lot of the reporters and writers and photojournalists are people that Maziar is very close to. And in terms that they are also people who are showing their country, trying to work for Western news agencies to kind of stretch the image to show more of Iran instead of less. And I started working with Maziar on the book. I got the feeling that he really did believe in the catchphrase. The Prince Klaus Fund are the people who paid for us, who paid for the book to go to print. And they have one of their policy statements is something called creating spaces of freedom. And I think that Maziar was also really interested in creating a space where people could express themselves. He believed in that. And I think that the books that I've done and not only the book that I've done with him, but also I did a book on Kaveh Golestan, an Iranian well-known photographer, photojournalist, BBC cameraman, who stepped on a landmine in 2003 and died, who was on assignment for the BBC with Jim Muir. Maziar has written for that book. And I think it's really important that he really felt that there should be these areas where, you know, Iranian culture, livelihood, experience could be shown in its full spectrum.
And I'd like to add something to that, which was that Maziar was also a bit of a teacher. And he has a project which, again, is funded by the Prince Klaus Fund in Burundi, which is sort of a reconciliation through drumming, which he goes out to do, I think, once a year. And he's been doing that for several years now. But the other thing which I also collaborated with Maziar on is he helped 10 Iranian filmmakers in a project to make a documentary each. Those documentaries have been sold around the world now, and that was an opportunity for young up-and-coming filmmakers in Iran to kind of get access to the wider kind of factual and documentary markets across
but
the world.
The documentary series, what I understand, I mean, you were there. The young filmmakers would pitch their ideas, and then they would go shoot, and they would show.
It was kind of a mini film school.
So it was like, and you were one of the as a film editor, you critiqued.
Yes, and well, in fact, we helped them to put the films together.
Yeah.
So it was
really really hands-on.
It was really hands-on.
Yeah.
And Maziar was very spent an awful lot of time in the middle of desperately trying to complete other films. And it took him, you know, a huge amount of energy for him to do that. And I think that was, you know, if you were talking about politics, Neil, you know, that was a political commitment on Maziar's part.
But also I think the Burundi project was also a political commitment on Maziar's part, because I can remember around the time, you know, the books that I do, because they're on the Middle East, because I get funding from Arts Council England, Iran Heritage, or the Prince Klaus Fund, they're enormously hard to do. And sometimes you can be working on a book. I mean, these book projects, I started in 2005, some of them, and then, you know, it goes quiet, you can't find the money. And I can remember having a conversation with Maziar, and I was saying, okay, we've got really good material here for transit, but maybe no one's going to pay for us to go to print. Maybe we're not going to make it. So the question I have to ask myself as the instigator of this project, as the person who believes in it, will I pay for it myself? Should I get my own money together and put it in? And Maziar said to me, the ideas you really believe in, the ideas you're really committed to, you've got to pay for. And because he's been paying, you know, he would, you know, some of his money went into the Burundi project. It was funded mainly by the Prince Klaus Fund, but it was his idea, and he made it happen. And I think that there are lots of people that are working in areas of the world where, you know, it's hard to get this material out. These are not commercial projects. No one is really interested. But, you know, people are committed to somehow push to get them to finish them and put them out.
And one of the horrible ironies in all of this is that Iran really needs people like Maziar to do that for the culture of Iran and the people of Iran. You know, the view that is out there in the mainstream press, which is basically just mullahs and, you know, demonstrations, is an absurd reduction of what is an incredibly vibrant and diverse culture. And it's so ironic and tragic that Maziar is being imprisoned by that regime.
That was one of the things I wrote, you know, early in the campaign. Newsweek said to all of us, said, you know, we want people to write about Maziar. We want you to write like an op-ed piece. And the op-ed piece that I wrote was like, how long does it take to make a Shia filmmaker? Because, I mean, it takes a long time. This guy is highly trained. You know, what are you going to do? You're going to throw them out? Come on. They don't grow on trees, people like this. And so that's why I feel that the Iranians, you know, they have someone special.
So how hopeful are we? I mean, Patrick, what do you think the success rate of things like your petitions are?
I think with Maziar and with the broader situation with lots of other people in Iran, the key really here is to continue pushing out. I mean, you know, the news agenda has somewhat moved on from Iran now. You know, people have got kind of slightly bored of the Friday people in the West have got slightly bored of protests on a Friday. We're moving on now. But the very important thing that we need to do is to stay focused on these threats and maintain the pressure just to make. And I think sometimes you can feel slightly when you're working in this kind of area that, you know, doesn't really make a difference. But it makes a massive difference just to keep the spotlight on someone, just to say we still want to know what's happening here and we still want people to have justice. The prospects in the short term, long, medium term, very, you know, as it's really reading the runes stuff. It's advanced.
You must have had successes before that you've at least contributed
We have. But this situation is just, as we've been saying, this situation is just so complicated in terms of we don't quite know who's pulling the strings here within the varied Iranian hierarchies. But what we can do is we can keep we can keep trying to find out, and we can keep the pressure on, and we can keep saying that Maziar and other people who are being held without any accusation, without any trial, merely for doing as Maziar did and others, trying to cast light in areas where the regime would prefer that the light is not cast, they deserve our support.
Well, let's do websites then. Where can people who want to find out about this campaign find?
Campaign to Protect Journalists, which is cpj.org, indexoncensorship.org, obviously. Newsweek has continued to keep up the pressure.
Also freemaziarbahari.org.
Can you spell his name? Because I don't think anyone listening will be able to
Maziar Bahari is M-A-Z-I-A-R-B-A-H-A-R-I. Bahari. And also, Transit Tehran is going to have an exhibition, and it's going to be at the Atrium Gallery at LSE, starting on the 28th of September until the 6th of June. And we're going to have two documentary film evenings on the 14th of October and the 21st of October at LSE. And we're going to show some of Maziar's films, some of the films that Maziar and Simon worked on with young Iranian documentaries, and also Masood Bakshi's Tour de Force, Tehran Has No More Pomegranates. And I'll be giving a talk about young Iran, its politics, stories, and pictures.
And we're also talking to a number of venues and institutions, including Index on Censorship and the Sheffield International Documentary Festival, to screen Maziar's films. So, you know, watch this space.
Mm-hmm. All right, so we're going to finish off. Well, Malo, you tell us what we're going to finish off
well,
with.
For the Kaveh Golestan book, Maziar wrote the preface, and he also wrote another article that we included, 9 scenes of Kaveh Golestan. And when I was looking through the writing that Maziar has done for my projects, I thought that these two essays said a lot, not only about Kaveh Golestan, who was one of Maziar's mentors, but also said a lot about the history of Iran, and also about Maziar when he was 12 and he met Kaveh for the first time. And these essays are included in the book Kaveh Golestan, 1950 to 2003, Recording the Truth in Iran. Legacy Like No Other by Maziar Bahari. I miss Kaveh. I miss listening to his stories, and boy, he had so many. In a single hour, he could tell you about his travails with the men in ties, the Shah's secret police, before the 1979 revolution, and his run-ins with the unknown soldiers of Iman Mahdi, the Islamic Republic's secret police after it. I miss Kaveh's encouragement and criticism. He knew just how to kick your ass for not doing better and make you feel good about getting your ass kicked. I wish I could have learned more from him. He had so much to offer, and he'd offer whatever he had to anyone willing to learn. What I miss the most is Kaveh's mischief. Working as a journalist in Iran may be one of the most difficult jobs in the world. It was a joy to see him deal with the Iranian officials, whose main job is making life for journalists miserable. Kaveh outsmarted them in their own game. "You resort to histrionics unnecessarily, Mr. Golestan," was the official standard line whenever Kaveh asked for permission to film something. "But I have reason to panic, sir. The whole world is waiting to hear about our country, and you're asking me to keep quiet?" Kaveh would answer as though his life depended on filming that day. The verbal ping-pong would go on for a few minutes. Kaveh always scored higher, much higher. 15 minutes? Okay, that's all I'm asking for. Thank you so much, sir. All the best." Then Kaveh would smile triumphantly. Journalism in Iran is a cat-and-mouse game, and Kaveh mastered the art of dodging the cat, whereas the officials were amateurs who defended the interests of whomever their boss was at a given time. Kaveh was a true professional and a patriot. He knew the history of Iran inside out. His love for his country was not irrational or sentimental. He had a real grasp of the conquerors, losers, poets, and assassins comprising the history of Iran. He documented a revolution and war under the close surveillance of government-appointed minders. His erudition and deep understanding of Iranian culture allowed him to know exactly what he wanted, and his ruthless professionalism allowed him to get it by any means necessary.
To Kaveh, there was nothing more important than recording the truth of his country, with all its faults and glory. His photographs are some of the most memorable in the photo album of Iran, and I miss him dearly. Kaveh Golestan in 9 scenes. Scene 1, Spring 1979. It's rare for a child to befriend his hero, but I did. I'm 12. My much older communist brother has doubts whether Iraj Iskandari, a former leader of Iran's Communist Party, had criticized the new party leadership in an interview. Our house is located a few doors away from the offices of Tehran-e-Mosavar, the magazine that published the interview. Like any good Bolshevik, my brother orders me to get the tape of the interview to verify its authenticity. The magazine's office is closed, but I have to get the tape, otherwise a proletarian punishment awaits me. I push the buzzer with one hand and knock on the door with the other. No response. While my dexterity is at its optimum, I think I should climb the wall to see if there is anyone in the offices. Maybe they just don't want to accept that they lied about Comrade Iskandari. Maybe they're afraid of me. I'm afraid of the gulag treatment awaiting me back home should I show up empty-handed. I'm deep in my thoughts when someone taps me on the shoulder. It is a guy with a big mustache and an even bigger smile. What are you doing, sir? Is there anyone in the office? He asks. I want to verify the authenticity of Iraj Iskandari's comments, I say. It surprises me that the friendly mustache doesn't laugh me off. Instead, he ponders this for a few minutes and gives me a sheepish look as if to say, I'm stuck here too. The friendly stranger has two cameras hanging from his neck. I've already decided to become a filmmaker 2 years ago. I have a book full of photos cut out from newspapers with the names of photographers written under them. Do you work here? I asked the mustache photographer. By then I had decided that my favorite foreign photographer was Margaret Burke White for her pictures of poor farmers in Depression-era America. To me, her Iranian equivalent is Kaveh Golestan, whose pictures of village students, workers, and prostitutes occupy prominent places in my photo collage notebook. Do you know Kaveh Golestan? I asked the friendly photographer. He has started cursing his colleagues who are late for their daily meeting. I am Kaveh Golestan, says Kaveh nonchalantly. I'm flabbergasted. He could have said, I am Pele, Fidel, Robert Redford, and I would have been less shocked. All of a sudden, my fears of being beaten by my brother are replaced by the excitement of meeting my hero. I want the magazine's office to be closed forever. But the door eventually opens. It turns out Iskandari has indeed criticized other leaders of the party. Kaveh takes me aside to show me his other photos. He tells me how he lived in Tehran's red light district for a few months to gain the trust of the prostitutes, pimps, and madams, and narrates his encounters with Savak, Iran's pre-revolution secret police. His stories reinforce my determination to become a journalist. I want to be like Mr. Golestan. Call me Kaveh, he says. Scene 2, June or July, 1979, Tehran University. I've just been slapped by a Maoist sympathizer for buying Jig-o-Dad, Shouting and Screaming, the satirical weekly magazine of the Islamic hardliners, including our current dear president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. I'm outside a room occupied by Fidayeens, an armed pro-Soviet communist guerrilla group. Salam, Kaveh! He's here to take pictures of an imminent attack by Hizbulis on the communists. Go get your camera, says Kaveh as he dashes off. There will be plenty of action here soon. Within minutes, sharp metal blades are thrown by radical Islamists at the Fidayeens. Many people are killed and seriously injured, but not Kaveh or me. Scene 3. Autumn, 1984, I think. Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance, Tehran. Tehran-e-Mosavar is shut down. The communists, the Fidayeens, and the Maoists are either killed or jailed. The Iran-Iraq War started 4 years ago. The ones who threw the blades are now in power. I've joined an amateur film society and am waiting for permission from the ministry to make a film with my Super 8 camera. Kaveh enters the ministry with a minder assigned by the Organization of War Propaganda. He is outraged, shouting at the minder, "How can you accuse me of such a thing when I've risked my life to show the soldiers in the front? You were there with me all the while. How can you blame me for something like that? How could I fabricate it? Why do you do this to me?" I just stand there and watch. The work of Kaveh and others like him don't meet with the narrow standards of this Islamic government. Many years later, I tell Kaveh about the day at the ministry. He doesn't remember it. That kind of clash with officials happened regularly. But he knew exactly who that minder was. He's now a very fashionable photographer who takes very fashionable photos and makes fashionable films. We thank God for minders minding more about their haircuts than other people's business. Scene 4, May 1997, London. I have been gone from Iran for 9 years now. Kaveh left a few months after the incident at the ministry. I haven't seen him, nor have I been in touch with him since that day. I tried to forget Iran and concentrate on my life in the West, but I can't. I long to go back. A friend lends me the Channel 4 film, Recording the Truth. She doesn't know who the filmmakers are, but she knows I'd appreciate it. Throughout the film, I remember the day of flying blades at Tehran University and Kaveh's frustration at the Ministry of Culture. For the first time in many years, I think about him and wonder how he is. As the credits end, Kaveh's name comes up as the co-director of the film. He's back in Iran. I decide to return. Scene 5, late 1997. Excited by the Tehran art scene but fearful of the Iranian government, I make an apolitical film about a group of artists and invite Kaveh to the editing room. What's this, he wonders. These people aren't saying anything, Maziar, says Kaveh as bluntly as he can. It's as if they live in a vacuum. There's nothing about the social or political situation of the country. Nothing. Yeah, but if they say something meaningful, we'll be in trouble, I mumble. What's the point of making a film, then? They should be ashamed of themselves for not saying something. But it's mainly your fault for putting their hollow words on film. Harsh words. But I knew I'd failed to make my film. Scene 6. Early 1998. The reformist Mohammad Khatami has been president of Iran for more than a year. The political scene is as open as it could ever get since the revolution. I tell Kaveh about my new film about the Tehran art scene. This time, it will be a film you'd like. Kaveh's eyes brighten. Marrakesh us! That's great, was Kaveh's catchphrase. Who knows, you may end up in Evin prison and beaten by the Ministry of Intelligence someday, he muses. A colleague of his recently received a beating by the secret police for a film she made with Kaveh about a children's asylum. But don't worry, that would be the ultimate badge of honor. Welcome to our club, Maziar. Scene 7, January 1999. Three political dissidents have been killed and one has gone missing. The four were on a list of almost 100 political dissidents and intellectuals. Unknown groups of hardliners had threatened to kill them for being heretics. Kaveh is number 20-something on the list. He shows me the images from the funeral of the poet and translator Mohammed Mokhtari, the third victim. The video is vintage Kaveh. Mokhtari's face is dark crimson. It is as though all the blood from his body accumulated under the skin of his face while being strangled by the killers. A car stops at the door. Kaveh pauses the video. There is a potential assassin in any car that stops at the door. Kaveh and I watch the door for a few minutes. The car goes away. Last night, I thought I couldn't sleep as a car was passing by my house every 5 minutes. Or maybe it was a nightmare that I couldn't sleep because a car was passing by my house every 5 minutes. Either way, Kaveh looks exhausted. Scene 8, October 2001. Iranian newspapers are being shut down one after another. A rogue Ministry of Intelligence agent responsible for serial murders is arrested and commits suicide inside prison a few weeks later. But everybody knows that the mystery is unsolved, that one man couldn't be responsible for the killings. The killers are free. They are the ones who are shutting the newspaper, says Kaveh. He's on his way to Herat, Afghanistan. I decide to stay in Iran to make a film about a religious serial killer instead of covering the fall of the Taliban. Kaveh is going to Afghanistan, not only for the action, but also because he's had enough of Iranian censors. You must reveal the secret of your loved ones by alluding to the strangers. Kaveh quotes a poem by Hafiz. The fundamentalists in Iran have a counterpart in the Taliban. They put you in jail if you criticize them in Iran, but you can criticize their ideas by criticizing the Taliban, he says. Scene 9, April 2nd, 2003. I receive a phone call. Kaveh stepped on a landmine. He's dead. More calls and then some more. No one believes Kaveh is dead and they want my confirmation. But he's not dead. His photos, videos, and most importantly, his pupils, the photographers he has influenced, are a living, breathing legacy.